This is KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Carly Huckles.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. Since 2001, tens of thousands of U.S. troops have been injured during wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. And every year, hundreds of them find strength and inspiration by competing in the military's Paralympics.
I will stay strong for the ones who cannot. I will fight for the ones who cannot fight. I will never quit on you. And I will finish strong.
We'll bring you a story of recovery ahead of the 2018 Warrior Games.
Farming in eastern Colorado has never been easy, whether it's because of the changing commodity prices or because some areas are just really dry.
How dry are they?
So dry that one farmer on the eastern plains has turned to growing air, sort of. We'll have the details. Clearly, it's no secret that we're dealing with a big water problem all over the West. But one of the solutions that has recently popped up in Colorado's race for governor is, shall we say, unique.
And honestly, trying to explain the importance of beavers in a minute is impossible.
Luckily, we can spend a few minutes talking about beavers and why on earth they're popping up in conversation for one gubernatorial candidate. Plus, our film critic Howie Mofshevitz lets us know whether First Reformed is worth checking out.
But first, as Colorado's population continues to grow, some law enforcement agencies don't have the resources to hire more officers. That's the case in the city of Longmont, which more than 93,000 people now call home. But the number of police officers hasn't kept up. But thanks to new state grants, the city now has more options to work with. KUNC's Stephanie Daniel recently went on a ride-along to see what's happening.
Police in Longmont typically respond to 6 or 7 calls each day that deal more with substance abuse and mental health issues than actual crimes. But the result was usually the same. A person was taken to jail or the emergency room.
Really, what we have are public health issues. And we're sending time and time again police officers who don't necessarily have the tools to deal with that issue.
Dan Eamon oversees Longmont's Office of Emergency Management and its 2 new core units, which is short for Crisis Outreach, Response, and Engagement.
It pairs a police officer with a licensed behavioral health clinician and a paramedic in a dedicated unit.
So instead of requesting a clinician after responding to a call, all 3 are at the scene together, connecting people to the services they need, like inpatient therapy, drug treatment, or even a hot meal.
We're really trying to use this different philosophy and mindset to get a different outcome.
The core units are so new, the paramedics haven't been hired yet.
I've got 877 on board and a civilian rider.
One of the units is made up of veteran police officer Tash Petsis and clinician Alan Marshke. Petsis has been with the department for 15 years.
Did you ask to be in this group or were you assigned?
I asked. We still respond to calls. I think just kind of the way we're dealing with those types of calls is different.
Marshke has been a clinician with the police for 4 years. The two have only been partners since April. While not in uniform, Marshke does wear a bulletproof vest under his street clothes.
We might be the first people on scene to something that's either appropriate for behavioral health, but there is a danger element, or, you know, if something happens right in front of us, Tash, of course, is going to keep the community safe, so he's still a police officer first.
In January, the state awarded grants to 12 communities to implement either the Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion, LEAD, or co-responder programs. Each partners behavioral health resources with law enforcement agencies. Longmont was one of only 2 departments in the state to apply for and receive money for both, which it uses to fund CORE.
Their statistics were definitely compelling in terms of their need.
Jagruti Shaw is the Director of Criminal Justice Services at the Colorado Department of Human Services Office of Behavioral Health. She oversaw the grant process.
They said within a 3-year period, They had 33 people commit suicide.
The Longmont Jail is like others across the state, where up to 40% of inmates have mental health or substance abuse disorders. It's about 1 p.m., and so far, Petsis and Marshke have responded to 2 calls about a man named John. He isn't doing anything illegal. John is just hanging around downtown, acting erratic. Petsis says it's not enough to arrest him.
These are those tough cases where Alan and I have conversations. You know, right now he's littering with that mess he left. But write him a ticket, it's not going to solve the problem. So this is where we have to start getting creative, and how are we going to get him engaged, and how are we going to get him help?
And something that further complicates things, there are no shelters or psychiatric facilities to take people to in Longmont. The 2 don't have much time to figure things out, because about 30 minutes later, dispatch radios in another call about John.
Hey, firm. I'm at 5th and Main. Where are you guys at?
We are the second unit to arrive on the scene.
I'm here to get you in trouble.
But after only a few minutes of trying to engage John, the conversation goes nowhere. So Petsus ends up putting him in handcuffs.
Stand up. It'll make things a lot easier. There you go.
And into the back of the police cruiser.
They treat you okay down there?
Oh, they treated me like a kid.
Yeah?
While Marshke chats with John in the back, I'm in the front with Officer Petsus.
So, and this is where his expertise comes in really great, because conversations that we have with, the mental health professionals, as an officer to a mental health professional, sometimes what we observe on the street gets lost because we don't have the same, I guess, vocabulary, for lack of better terms. But since Alan's got the training and the vocabulary, he's able to communicate that to the person that'll be evaluating him.
Soon, we arrive at a local hospital and drop off John for a mental health evaluation.
We'll take care of you, John.
As we go back out on patrol, clinician Alan Marshke says he hoped the John call would have turned out differently.
But at the same time, we can only do what we can do, so at least we know he's safe. You know, he's getting the care that he needs. He's not going to put himself in harm's way or other people in harm's way. And we'll leave it up to the hospital evaluators to determine what needs to happen next.
Charles 244.
But this isn't the end of the police department's interaction with John. Dan Eamon of the Office of Emergency Management says Corps will assign a peer support specialist or case manager to follow up.
It's amazing what happens when you show somebody that you care and just treat a human being like a human being. And that's some of the feedback that we've gotten from our patients already. It's amazing that somebody cared.
His office hopes to have the two paramedics hired and on the teams by July. But even without full staffing, the Longmont Corps teams have quickly become the busiest units in the city since starting last month.
That was Stephanie Daniel, who covers the opioid crisis and education for KUNC. At one point, hundreds of millions of beavers populated North America. But as settlers moved west, they trapped them to near extinction. Now, scientists say the loss of beavers caused immeasurable damage to mountain ecosystems. As KUNC's Luke Runyon reports, efforts are underway to boost their numbers and, in turn, get us more comfortable with the way they engineer the environment.
It's early in the morning, and Julie Scamardo and I are wearing grayish-green chest waders trudging through mud to find a beaver meadow inside Rocky Mountain National Park.
These are like mazes. It's hard to get through a meadow and know where you're going.
Scamardo is a master's student at Colorado State University. She's studying how beavers alter landscapes. This valley is home to about 24 beavers, and moving through their habitat is like walking on a massive sponge.
Oh, God.
Well, they cause a lot of sediment deposition. We're kind of stepping through all that right now.
Few species transform their surroundings enough to make big ecological changes. Humans are one of them. Beavers are another.
They definitely are engineers, and they change their environment to suit them, and it also happens to suit a lot of other species.
Like birds, fish, and insects. And scientists have shown that we get lots of benefits, too. Beaver dams improve water quality, trap and store carbon, and replenish groundwater. That's why reintroduction projects are underway in states like Nevada, Utah, and Wyoming.
Hi, my name's Scott Hulker. I'm running for governor.
And the idea of using beavers to help with some of the West's water problems is popping up in unexpected places. Hulker is the Libertarian candidate in Colorado. I met him at his home.
And honestly, the first time I introduced this, I had 1 minute. Trying to explain the importance of beavers in a minute is impossible.
In fact, beaver reintroduction is one of the main planks of his entire campaign.
It's one part of many solutions, but it's a cheap solution. It's easy to do, and it'll fill up the aquifers, and that's what we want to accomplish, I think.
Bringing beavers back into areas that haven't seen them in a long time may seem like a novel approach, but it's been done before. Not long after World War II, the Idaho Department of Fish and Game relocated beavers throughout the state.
In preparing for the operation, beaver must be sorted for even size and weight.
In this promotional film, men dressed in slacks and tucked-in shirts load beavers into wooden crates with parachutes attached. Yes, at one point, we dropped beavers from airplanes.
Now into the air and down they swing, down to the ground near a stream or a lake.
Now, that probably wasn't the best approach, according to Ellen Wohl, a geoscience professor at Colorado State University. She says reintroduction efforts need to be more targeted.
There are lots of places we can't reintroduce beaver because there's just too much urbanization and the river corridor is too constrained.
Wohl also says our concepts about beavers need to change. They're still considered to be a nuisance in many states, an animal that gnaws trees and floods basements.
There are a lot of ways to live with beaver, but you have to be willing to think about those or to think about other alternatives rather than killing the animals.
And it's not just our ideas about the animals that are problematic, says science writer Ben Goldfarb. In his new book, he says rivers and streams should be full of beavers and messy.
These sorts of beaver-influenced watersheds are actually, in many cases, more natural than, you know, the classic shallow, clear riffle stream that people like me like to fish.
Back in Rocky Mountain National Park, Julie Scamardo says sections of the park and vast swaths of the American West seem primed for a beaver comeback, but they're not showing up.
And so we're still kind of asking the question of, like, what else do you want? And having a beaver psychologist would really be the best for one of these projects, but we don't have any of those, so.
We might not know their innermost thoughts, but that's not stopping researchers like Scamardo from trying to boost beaver populations. And while they don't have any set plans for reintroduction, park officials have entertained the idea of bringing beavers in to help regrow vegetation along streams. Though they probably won't drop them from airplanes.
He's on his way now. His nose and his instinct tell him where to find the water. There's room here for a new home.
I'm Luke Runyon.
Now let's move from water to dry land. And by dry land, I mean really dry land.
Yeah.
The Homestead Act of 1862 included 160 acres of land on which hardy pioneers could build a home and grow crops. It lured people from all over the world to the western U.S., including one Colorado family that is still here, four generations later. But farming on the dry eastern plains hasn't always been easy. And as KUNC's Ray Ellen Bichelle reports, a new kind of crop could change things.
Andy and Lucy Cochis arrived in eastern Colorado in 1908. If it looked then like it does now, this is what they saw. High, dry plains were just about the only moving things are tumbleweeds and the occasional antelope. And here's the important thing, barely any water. Thousands like them would fail on this land. But somehow, Andy and Lucy didn't.
How they ever made it through the 30s, I have no idea.
That's Virgil Cochis, Andy and Lucy's grandson. He says his grandparents made it, even through the Depression and the Dust Bowl. They built a bigger house, bought a car, raised 13 kids.
I mean, they had to be tough.
That's Jan Cochis. She's married to Virgil. Today, the farm has mushroomed from 160 acres to 10,000, but it's still dry out here.
Sure it is. Last year, we didn't have any wheat. We planted in the dust, and it stayed in the dust.
They're still dryland farmers, which means no irrigation.
In this area, there isn't enough water to irrigate, or the water is too deep. And so that means all the water that comes from above.
And the forces above are not forgiving. The weather meter near the door says they've gotten 1.29 inches of rain in the last 4 months.
That is nothing.
It also says it's kite-flying weather outside, which is a cheerful twist on dry, but it also hints at something else. Wind. See, Virgil and Jan Cochis are in the middle of making a big change. We step outside to take a look. The Cochises have made it 110 years of unpredictable rainfall, fluctuating commodity prices, juggling side jobs, and changing crops to keep the farm afloat. Now, they're taking on a new crop, air.
All right, so what are we looking at?
Well, I think we have a good view of our new wind farm, or our new crop of wind turbines. In the middle of a wheat field.
A few energy companies have approached them over the last 20 years, but this is the first time one has actually followed through. Colorado's biggest utility, Xcel Energy, is about to finish building the state's biggest wind farm. We're looking at a piece of it, towering over the wheat fields.
And are those cows that we see out there? Are those yours?
Cows in the distance.
Yes.
Yep.
Look
looks like they maybe like the turbines. They're all nestled up right under that one.
Right. Yeah. The turbines stand 30 stories off the ground. Their blades are sleek and smooth as dolphins. Virgil says they look good.
What does it look like to you?
Money.
The Cochises have already been getting checks from Xcel for the last few years. First, while the company scoped out where to put the turbines, and now while they're getting ready for production. Going forward, Cochise Farms will get a minimum of about $6,000 per turbine each year. More once they start producing electricity.
Yes. So it's just like rental, sort of like rental income is what it ends up being.
Doing the math, that's a bare minimum of $180,000 a year. About a 60% increase on what the farm currently brings in a good year.
Which is nice because depending on what the commodity prices are doing, I mean, right now commodity prices are pretty low. And so it can be a nice supplement to that. And you might be able to buy an extra piece of equipment or do something like that.
Jan says other family members were skeptical about the wind farm at first.
I think their main issue was the fact that they were going to be digging these holes, putting all this concrete in the ground. And they said, well, then what happens if it goes away? Well, in the contract, it says if they would ever decide to decommission the wind farm, they have to remove everything.
That realization and the regular checks made the decision easier. Plus, they'll keep farming as if the turbines weren't there.
You can farm around them. Cattle can graze around them.
With the wind farm on the property, this might be the first time in 110 years that the farm itself will produce a reliable income.
So is the farm going to keep going?
I think so, yeah.
Virgil and Jan's son, Michael, is out there now. He's the fourth generation of Cochise farmers.
At least it'll go one more generation.
And the turbines should start turning this fall. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Raelynn Bichelle.
More than 52,000 troops have been injured during the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, and elsewhere since 2001. And each year, hundreds of them compete in the military's Paralympics, known as the Warrior Games. KUNC's Michael DeIwana has the story of two soldiers and the role the games have played in their lives.
If you want to get Israel Del Toro talking, just mention the military or sports.
There's pictures of guys I met, athletes. Most of them are athletes because I love sports.
Del Toro is an Air Force Senior Master Sergeant. He teaches parachute jumping at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. Friends call Del Toro DT. And these are the photos in his home of some of the people he's met in recent years.
Oh, there's Gary Sinise.
Gary Sinise knows me very well. George Lopez, of course, President Bush is all over the place.
And even Prince Harry.
This is his favorite picture of us. He even said, I love this picture of me and you, DT. And he even signed it with my quote, never effing quit.
Which has been the theme of Del Toro's life in just about every way imaginable.
Ladies and gentlemen, Master Sergeant Israel Del Toro, Jr.
Del Toro's well known, too. He got a standing ovation from a room packed with sports heroes and celebrities at last year's ESPYs when he was honored with the Pat Tillman Award for Dedication to Service in Sports.
To all my wounded, injured, ill service members, disabled civilians, or anyone who's having a bad day, I will stay strong for the ones who cannot. I will fight for the ones who cannot fight. I will never quit on you, and I will finish strong.
His acceptance speech takes on greater significance when you see how he got to this point. He joined the military in 1997, wanting a challenge in life, and because of 9/11, he deployed to war. In 2005, Del Toro was in Afghanistan when he was severely injured by an IED explosion.
I'm fired from head to toe, and then collapsing, thinking I'm going to die there, and a teammate helped me up. And luckily, there's a creek about 200 meters behind us, and we jumped in to extinguish the flames.
Not fully aware of his injuries, he helped get word of the attack to an air team, and that's when things started to fade. Del Toro remembers thinking about his then 3-year-old son and bits of his rescue.
Flying off to our forward operating base, going into our field hospital, seeing some of my teammates there. My watch getting cut off.
It was December 4th, 2005.
I wake up March of 06.
He was at Brooke Army Medical Center in San Antonio, Texas, covered in bandages. He had third-degree burns over 80% of his body. Fingers were missing, and the doctors began telling him he'd never walk again or breathe without a respirator.
Everyone's like waiting to see what I'm going to say. They're all looking. And I couldn't talk because I had a trach, so they were just reading my lips. But what I repeated was some colorful words, but pretty much I told him, you know, you can go to hell.
His recovery and therapy was off the charts painful.
So my hands, you could have rubbed a feather across and it felt like you were cutting me with razor blades. And then learning how to walk, you think it's easy, but it's probably some of the most painful stuff I had to go through. But every day I had to do it because I wanted to show my son, if you kept a positive mind, if you find that fire inside of you, you'll overcome any odds.
And by far, Del Toro exceeded the expectations of his doctors. In 2 months, he was ready to go home, but he found himself struggling, filled with doubt.
The only time I had ever wished I died was when I first saw my face. And it wasn't a vanity thing. It really wasn't. If I thought I was a monster, it's like, God, what's my three-year-old son going to think?
He listened to his wife, Carmen, and a therapist who told him that his son really just wants his dad.
I was like, okay. It's like, I'll just keep going. And so when I finally saw him when I got out of the hospital, you know, he comes running out. And, you know, I'm all bandaged up. And he stops. And all that fear comes rushing back. He's like, oh, my God, he's terrified of me. He's not going to want to hold me. And he looks, tilts his head to the side, and he says, Papi. I'm like, yeah, buddy. And he comes up and gives me the most amazing hug I've ever had.
More than 100 surgeries later, and that brings us to the Warrior Games in Colorado Springs.
So each service has a program where they help their wounded, ill, and injured service members, introduce them to adaptive sports, to have other programs to help them during their recovery and rehabilitation.
That's Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Carrie Hepp. She says about 300 troops will compete this year, as will teams from Britain, Australia, and Canada.
We just bring everybody together from the different service teams to compete and inspire us with telling us how they overcame their obstacles that they may have faced.
Now they've been able to show us how to take this into our recovery and get back on our feet.
Air Force Master Sergeant Michael Christensen will compete in the games. He was in Kirkuk, Iraq in 2004 when an explosion threw him into the side of a Humvee. His spine was permanently damaged, but he can race a recumbent bicycle, play sitting volleyball, and participate in other events.
This has given me that drive and excitement in my life again to be able to compete and show that I've come somewhere from being injured, from basically just sitting around not thinking that there was anything more for me in that aspect.
And that's how Israel Del Toro got to the games as well. He's participated in past Warrior Games, and he won a gold medal in shot put during Prince Harry's Invictus Games for wounded troops. But this week, he's sitting in the stands, cheering on the others.
I wanted to almost transition into like a coach and a mentor, because that's what you should do. You should come back and give back.
Christensen will be looking for Del Toro.
DT is an inspiration. What he's been through and how he's overcome everything. I mean, I've got my injuries, but DT is definitely, he's been through a lot.
Del Toro has also opened the door for disabled troops like Christensen to stay in the military if they want. In 2010, Del Toro was the first airman to re-enlist, even though he was eligible for a full military retirement. The Air Force supported him in transitioning to an instructor role.
I still had a job to do, so that's what I did. I was showing the military that I still had value. I could still contribute to the military.
And even though he's 43 years old, sports still figure big in his life. Del Toro says he's training to compete in the 2020 Paralympics in Tokyo.
Michael DeJoanna covers military and veterans issues for KUNC. You can follow him on Twitter at MDY1. You might say the new film First Reformed by the venerable Paul Schrader is about two churches and a minister. But to really understand the movie, KUNC film critic Howie Mofshevitz, who teaches film and television at CU Denver, says you need to know who Paul Schrader is.
It's no surprise that Paul Schrader's film about a crisis of faith should include a suicide vest, barbed wire, and a bottle of Drano. Schrader's the writer of Taxi Driver and Raging Bull. He both wrote and directed The Comfort of Strangers, Light Sleeper, and Affliction. None of these are for the faint of heart, and neither is First Reformed. Schrader opens First Reformed with a straight-on shot of a 250-year-old Dutch Reformed church. It's white and symmetrical. The steeple shoots into the air, aiming for heaven. Most of the film's shot in a squared-off style. It's even filmed in the rarely used Academy ratio, which is closer to square than the widescreen formats. The camera rarely moves. The lines are rigid horizontals and verticals, which fit both the church and its minister, the Reverend Toller, Ethan Hawke. The church and the Reverend Toller are in trouble. Toller preaches to maybe 8 or 10 faithful. Most of the churchgoers in this upstate New York town go to the megachurch next door, which in fact owns and runs the little church as a curiosity. Toller lives a life as spare and joyless as his building. His feet echo as he walks across his bare antique wooden floors. He eats his meager dinner from one lonely bowl at a small table in a bleak room. His bed looks neat and trim and unoccupied. 4 books are piled rigidly on a night table. You can bet that none of them are comedies. He also drinks. The megachurch is run by a hefty African-American, Cedric Kiles, who presents his religion with lively and pragmatic common sense and even something like wisdom. A terrible event, Toller takes it as a personal failure, sets him into his downward spiral. Toller's overriding theological question is whether God can forgive humanity for destroying the environment of the earth, and it's a question the film takes seriously. Paul Schrader grew up in a home he describes as conservative Christian. Theology was a major force, but Reverend Toller's questions about faith as a response to the huge problem of human misbehavior are not typical of American filmmaking. Life has battered Toller. He lost a son to war and a wife to what followed. The preacher next door sees that Toller's retreated from life, but he doesn't see how Paul Schrader deals with this level of self-repression. Think Travis Bickle of Taxi Driver. And remember that Schrader has never given in to the force of plausibility. The levitation sequence may be loony, but it's also inspired. Toller spends more and more time counseling his comely young parishioner Mary, Amanda Seyfried. It's hard to tell what she's thinking, but Toller resists anything involving human feeling. Mary suggests a physical interaction that sends Toller into the heavens, although he so resists even imaginative pleasure that his journey winds up in a dump. Schrader's been asked why he did the sequence. He said that he was stuck for what to do with the two characters, so he asked himself what the great spiritual filmmaker Andrei Tarkovsky would do. The answer was levitate. But that ain't the half of it. There's still the suicide vest, barbed wire, and Drano. As Tolstoy famously said, if you show a gun in the first act, it had better go off in the third. But this is not what we expect, and neither's the ending. For all the theatrics of the last third of First Reformed, the theological debate does not go away. The earth really is in trouble, and human beings as a group seem stymied about what to do. It's one kind of problem for secular environmentalists, but it's another for people of faith. Years ago, Schrader said that he was raised to have the faith of a child, but not the mind of a child. First Reformed puts that notion to a test. For KUNC, I'm Howie Mobshevitz.
This has been Colorado Edition.
Our intro music is Remember Me by Colorado musician Calatana.
Other music in this episode came from Forest Robots, Follow the Towers to the Moon, and By the Stillness of the Lake. We heard Peterloo Massacre's song Never Forget and Fog Lake with their song Oak Island.
Our outro music is Good Grief by Ryan Little.
Our show this week was produced by me, Carly Huckles.
And me, Erin O'Toole. Editors Ashley Jeffcoat and Brian Larson also contributed to our show. If you like what you're hearing, make sure you don't miss an episode. We'll be back with a new one next week.
You can subscribe to Colorado Edition on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to join us next Sunday evening at 9 on KUNC.